Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of February. Our guests this hour are the co-authors of News for All the People, the epic story of race and the American media. Juan Gonzalez is one of our guests, one of the authors of the book, two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Commentary, former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, columnist for New York's Daily News, and co-host of the TV and radio news show Democracy Now!, also author of Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America, and Fallout, The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse. Also joining us, first let's say hello to Juan. Hi, Juan. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also joining us is Joseph Torres, Senior Advisor for Government and External Affairs for Free Press, National Media Reform Organization. He earlier worked as Deputy Director at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Joseph, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you. Our number for you to join the conversation as we talk this hour is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's go way back, gentlemen, to the years before the Civil War, and you highlight the huge number of Spanish-language newspapers before the Civil War, the number of Native American newspapers, and several Chinese newspapers. Why did they flourish then, and what happened to them?
Well, one of the points that we make is that the federal government, in its early policies in terms of mass communications through the creation of the postal system in 1792, which essentially provided for subsidies, government subsidies for the delivery of newspapers to people's homes, that made it possible for basically anyone in the early 19th century and mid-19th century who could publish a newspaper to have the government deliver it at far below market rates in terms of delivery costs. So that allowed for a really an early flourishing of independently owned Latino, African-American, Asian newspapers. You had as early in New Orleans as 1808, the first Spanish language newspaper of Mississippi, but you had about 25 Spanish language newspapers being published in New Orleans just before the Civil War, and all about 100 across the country. You had African-American newspapers, more than 30 before the Civil War, including Freedom's Journal, the first one in 1827. You had Rolling Hills, Golden Hills News, the first Chinese language newspaper in 1854 in San Francisco, and about 25 Chinese language newspapers before the turn of the 20th century. So that you had really a whole separate press of these, of Asian Americans and Native Americans as well. The Cherokee Phoenix in 1828 being the first Native American newspapers, several others being published in the Oklahoma Territory. So there was a vibrant, independent press of people of color in the early and late 19th century.
And what was it that was covered in those newspapers that was not covered in the, if we can call it, non-minority press, the press that should speak to everybody but probably spoke mostly to white people in the country?
Well, I think the rise of this independent press was a direct reaction to the fact that the established or largely white press of the day was only covering African Americans or Native Americans in terms of as the other, as sources of violence, in constantly portraying Native Americans essentially as violent savages, that and so this press arose directly to counter that narrative, to begin talking about the accomplishments of the African American community, of the Native American community, the hopes and aspirations of those communities, their attempts to achieve equal rights and standing within American society. So you had quite a bit of telling the full story of what was happening in those communities, as opposed to just the emphasis on crime and violence that became so dominant in the mainstream or white press of the time.
Mm-hmm. Joseph, tell me about this publication, Public Occurrences.
Sure. If I can add one point to Juan, which is saying just now, too, also was happening at the time, too, when these papers were coming up. There were federal policies that were removing Native Americans from the land. So, like, the first Native American newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix, was openly talking about the hostile government policy that was, you know, moving them from their land. And then you had a lot of white editors of northern newspapers in particular writing about the freeing blacks, you know, against the institutional slavery, but for deporting all African Americans to Liberia. And so you had these papers that were fighting against these policies that were being fought out in the federal government that was openly racist and it led to the removal of Native Americans from their land. Now, the Public Occurrences was the first publication in the United States during the colonial times in Massachusetts in 1690. And Benjamin Harris. And what was interesting about this paper, it was the first paper in the country published. And with the first edition of the paper, there were five stories that were covered that were about Native Americans. It was about Native Americans and it was the fear of the Native Americans and how they were going to the kidnapping of children, and it was one story. Thanksgiving being celebrated with Native Americans. So it was an intelligence sheet almost to the white settlers about the dangers and the harms of Native Americans in the Massachusetts colonies. But what that was an example of, we talk about in the book, that it is an example that race has been at the center of media coverage from the very beginning, from the first printed words in our country to the present day. Race is not a side issue in the coverage of people of color in this country. It's always been a central focus of media coverage from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, we point out that in certain periods in the 1700s, as much as a third of the total content of colonial newspapers was information for the settlers about what the various native tribes were up to, and either about conflicts with the natives or individual incidents of violence between natives and settlers. So it was a huge topic in the early period, as Joe says, intelligence to the settlers about the Native American population. And then, of course, another big portion was information to the settlers about Africans, either violence by individual slaves against their masters, slave insurrections, or problems of free blacks in the northern colonies in terms of having conflicts with the white population. So a big portion of colonial era content was about Africans and Native Americans, even though, of course, it was all geared to the white settler population. Mm-hmm.
What about when Native Americans were fighting alongside, or fast forward to the Civil War, African Americans were fighting alongside whites in wars? They were fighting with them. Was that noticed in newspaper coverage?
Well, are you talking about Native Americans fighting
Native Americans
in the Civil War, or
Native Americans helping out the early settlers? You know, stories of goodwill
About the only positive stories, right, that you found in those early papers were either of slaves who gave information about attempts at insurrections, or about Native Americans who joined with and helped the settlers against other natives who were in conflict with the settlers. Those were the usual positive stories. In essence, those slaves or those Native Americans who came over to the side of the settlers received the positive coverage. What you did find later on, though, and especially during the Civil War, is that there was a, because, you know, most of the early newspapers were produced by the Cherokee. The Cherokee developed the first written native language, and therefore they had a leg up on the other Native American nations in terms of developing their own press. But the Cherokee also were one of the native tribes that themselves held slaves. So you do find debates in the native papers over the issue of slavery, and you do find later on several prominent native leaders, Cherokee leaders, joining with the South to maintain slavery, as opposed to fighting in solidarity with African Americans. And we point out not only the various press of people of color who stood up against the racial narrative, the dominant racial narrative, but we also point out the contradictions that existed among groups or within groups in terms of their own biases and prejudices that existed, whether it's in the African American community or the Native American or the Asian American or Latino communities.
Yeah. Let's spend some time talking about, his name has come up in several conversations this week, Frederick Douglass, who, as you cite, was the editor of several African-American newspapers in his lifetime and had a lot to say about the U.S. war against Mexico, of course, had a lot to say about civil rights. Tell me about his newspapers and his role in spreading information, how he was received.
Well, Frederick Douglass was clearly the key African-American newspaper editor of the early 19th century, publishing about six different papers, including Frederick Douglass's paper, the North Star, and others. And the what's important about Douglass is not only that he was such an eloquent writer and defender of the rights of the slaves of the United States to be free, but also that he championed women's rights and gave an opportunity for women writers in his newspaper to raise feminist issues and to raise issues about the involvement of women in the freedom struggle. Mary Ann Shad Carey, one of the earliest African American women editors, got her start by writing articles for Douglass's paper. And also Douglass was uncompromising in his opposition to the creation of an American empire, especially the expansion westward and the seizure of Mexican land. So he wrote unbelievably eloquent narratives about what was going on in the Mexican War, about the atrocities that were occurring in the Mexican War, and about the silence of his fellow journalists and religious leaders over the United States' involvement in the Mexican War.
If I can add, Kathleen, to that,
of course,
too, is that Freedom Journal was the nation's first African American newspaper, founded in 1827, as we note in the book. Several of the first African American newspapers, while they addressed racism and they addressed efforts to, recolonize, for lack of a better word, African Americans back to Africa, Frederick Douglass and other editors coming later. They were the first African American editors, like Freedom Journal, they were free. They were free blacks living in the North. They were not born into slavery. When Frederick Douglass comes along, is a new type of editor who was once a slave owner, who was a slave. Now, more directly challenging the institution of slavery directly, as opposed to the first African American newspapers came along, so they were much more harsher in their critique of slavery. Frederick Douglass and the editors that came along after the creation of Freedom's Journal in 1827.
Hmm. As the country becomes, and it will soon be, a majority minority, how many African-American newspapers, Hispanic newspapers, Asian newspapers do we have in this country now? Is the number significantly higher than what you outlined at the beginning of the country, or is it lower?
Well, there are certainly many more newspapers today, largely, though, weeklies, because remember, back in the 19th century, most newspapers were weeklies until you started getting in the big cities to have daily newspapers, what's happened, unfortunately, is that there are virtually very few African American or Latino owned daily newspapers in the country anymore. There are lots of weeklies, but in fact, many of the Spanish language dailies have in recent decades been purchased by American companies, even Lopin Young in Los Angeles and El Diario La Prensa in New York, the two most well-known dailies, are no longer owned by Latinos. What you've seen is there has been a proliferation of weeklies, but in terms of daily newspapers, which are the most influential these days in terms of helping to shape the public's understanding of what's going on, you're seeing fewer and fewer dailies that are actually owned by Latinos or African Americans. And the same thing is happening even in radio and television, that while the population of the country is exploding in terms of the minority population, the actual ownership of media outlets, of major media outlets, by people of color is decreasing, and it's an astonishing divergence of trends. A growing population, but a decreasing ownership of major media.
Yeah, what were you, your figures? Were 7.7% of commercial radio stations, and 3.2% of TV are owned by minority business people.
Right, and when it comes to newspapers, daily newspapers, virtually none.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there are about 1,400 daily newspapers still in the United States, there's been a steady decline from the height of the mid 20th century, but there's still 1,400 daily newspapers in the United States.
What's interesting is that Spanish language newspapers still play a critically vital role, even the weeklies in communities across the country. What's interesting is that we talk about in the book a lot, is the historic role of the black press. And, you know, during the early part of, the last century, during the First World War, the Second World War, the black press, they had enormous circulations, 250,000, 300,000 circulation. These were weekly papers like the Pittsburgh Courier, the Chicago Defender. The black press is not as vibrant as it once was as far as the weekly newspapers. They've struggled through the years, are struggling, and they were played such a critical role. It was such an important institution, a powerful institution in the black community, that influence is waning a little bit over the past several decades. But it's not true of the Spanish language daily newspapers. They still play a critically important role in because of the growth of the country and the population and the immigrant population, mm-hmm. and the importance of these newspapers making members of the community feel, helping to participate in daily life and society.
Yeah. And now, of course, we're in this whole new age, and you write about this in the book, where newspapers are going under, and the role of the Internet and how we make sure that there are minority voices or thoughts on this. It's just, it's a whole new world, isn't it? It's hard to figure out where everything is coming from, and so little of it is addressing local communities in any way at all.
Well, that's, one of the things that we try to do in this book is draw the lessons from the historical evolution of the media so that those who are concerned about what is happening with our media system today can learn those lessons. And one of the things that we've concluded in the book is that, yes, there is an enormous revolution in mass communications occurring today as a result of the Internet, but that this is not the first revolution in mass communications in this country, but that, in fact, every time a new technology for mass communication is developed, it upsets the existing media order and requires the government to step in and come up with new rules of operation of the new technology. So that it happened, obviously, when Congress developed the postal system, which became the main incubator of newspapers. It happened again when the telegraph was developed and provided the opportunity for instant news and information to flow around the country. It happened again with the early development of radio, and from the amateur radio to then commercial radio, where the government stepped in and developed the Federal Radio Commission and then the Federal Communication Commission to bring order to the airwaves. And then it happened again in cable, when cable created a whole new decentralized system of providing television television to the American people, and now it's happened for the fifth time, really, another technological revolution in mass communications with the Internet. And at every one of these stages, what happens is huge battles break out in Washington over what will be the new rules of operation for this. How will news and information flow in a democracy? And what will this new media technology mean for the preservation of that democracy? And it's precisely at those periods when the government has to come up with new rules that it's incumbent on citizen groups, that it's and stakeholders in a more democratic media system to step in and be heard. And one thing that we found is that in every one of these battles, a fundamental issue has come up. Does a democracy need a centralized system of news and information, or does it need a decentralized, local, autonomous system of news and information? And at different times, depending on the technology, the government has sided with one or the other sides of this question. And so this is what's occurring now with all of the various issues that are related to the Internet now, whether it's the issue of net neutrality, whether it's the issue of what will be the future of public access on cable, whether it's the issue of citizen privacy, the privacy rights on the Internet, a gamut of issues that are arising with the new technology as all the platforms merge onto the Internet, print, voice, and video. And really, key decisions are being made for the future of our media system in Washington that most of the public is not aware of or knows little about.
Yeah. And the ownership issues, which you say as well, we can own an incredible number of outlets in any one place or around the country. So you get the same kind of news. We've heard reports you might be getting you're not getting local news because you're getting the same kind of thing because you're broadcasting to so many communities across the country, all owned by the same corporate entity.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, Kathleen, that one of the things about that is that, media consolidation has been shown to be just horrible for the quality of news. It's the reason why we wrote this book. That originally got us on this journey to write this book. Consolidation has been terrible for journalism, terrible for newsrooms. The number of journalists have been laid off as a result.
Yes.
And when we talk about newspapers, everyone just thinks because the Internet has come along, it's automatically meant the death of newspapers. What people do not realize that the reason why newspapers are suffering so much, one of the primary reasons, is because of consolidation. These companies cannot pay back the debt they acquired from all the different mergers that were happening over the past 20 or 30 years. As so many of the largest companies in this country, newspaper companies, are publicly traded companies, and they were making obscene profit margins, 25% profit margins. They're still profitable. Newspapers are still profitable. They're just not making the monopoly profits that they thought they were entitled to years ago. And as a result, they are pressuring government to this day to allow for the FCC to allow for further consolidation so newspapers can go and buy more TV stations across the country. But the lesson we have to learn is that consolidation is bad for journalism. It's bad for diversity in the media. It makes it harder for people of color to own media properties. But these companies have major lobbies that continue to pressure the government to change rules, and like as Juan said, they do a terrible job of reporting what they're up to at the FCC. While they may report what's going on at the EPA and in Congress, they have little interest in reporting on the rules they're trying to get changed in D.C.
We welcome phone calls, and let me give you our number. Our guests are the authors of News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. Juan Gonzalez and Joseph Torres are our guests. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. Juan is Democracy Now! Co-host and award-winning columnist at the New York Daily News, former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and Joseph Torres is senior advisor for government and external affairs for Free Press and former deputy director at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Lines are open for you to join our conversation, and we'll continue it in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests this hour are the authors of News for All the People, the epic story of race and the American media. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This book covers a lot of territory, from the first colonial newspaper to the age of the internet, and it has dramatic chapters on horrific record of the white press in fomenting mob violence and massacres against non-white communities. We'll be sure and talk about that as we continue our conversation. 800-486-8655. Vicki, our first caller from Manitowoc. Hi, Vicki.
Good morning, and I called to thank our authors. I've seen Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now!, which is where I discovered him, and his co-author, of whom I'm becoming more aware. And I think that we all knew that in terms of a great deal of news that really is happening internationally, we're badly served. But the area they have highlighted is how the non-white majority in the history of this country. I'm looking forward to reading this book. I have not read it, but I'm very much looking forward to it. And I think they have done us a real service, and that's what I call to say.
Thank you so much, Vicki, for the call. Gentlemen?
Well, yes. I think one of the things we've tried to do is sort of resurrect and bring back the human stories of all of these valiant editors of color who have been largely forgotten. I mean, a few are well known. Frederick Douglass, of course, is well known, and Martin Delaney, and some other African Americans. But the great Native American journalists, John Rowland Ridge and Elias Boudinot and Ora Edelman Reed, these were all really pioneering journalists among the Native peoples that are virtually unknown by the rest of the country. Likewise, for the Latino and the Asian American journalists, we felt it was necessary to tell their stories and actually quote what they wrote or what they said on the radio to really show people the rich way that they attempted to defend and expand freedom of the press in America.
Mm-hmm. Another one of those people, if you would tell his story, because there are many of these and we just don't know them, the story of Pedro Gonzalez, who was a radio host.
Yes, well, Pedro Gonzalez was in he started out as a laborer on the docks when he came from Mexico in Southern California, but he was a singer and with a wonderful voice. He cut a few records and became very popular, so they offered him a radio station in Los Angeles, offered him a radio show, and it was an early morning show, and Gonzalez and his band would play music for the farm workers and the Latino farm workers in Southern California in the 1930s. This was just around the time that Herbert Hoover initiated a mass deportation program of the federal government against the Mexican immigrants, because it was in the depths of the recession, of the depression, and the Hearst newspaper chain was clamoring for the government to remove undocumented Mexicans who had claimed were taking jobs from unemployed Americans. And so Hoover initiated a mass deportation program where more than a million Mexicans were basically rounded up in raids of communities throughout the Southwest, put on trains and shipped to Mexico, many of them being American citizens who were just caught up in these roundups. So what ends up happening is Pedro Gonzalez begins using his radio show, turning it from a music show into a show that is exposing these human rights violations. He is suddenly arrested by the Los Angeles District Attorney on a rape charge, convicted, and sentenced to, I think it was 2 to 30 years in San Quentin prison. He is in prison for several years until the young woman he was convicted of raping recants her testimony.
Oh, my.
And admits that she was put up to it by prosecutors. So he has to be released from jail in 1940. but then is immediately deported from the country and sent to Tijuana, Mexico, where he remained a radio announcer for decades in Tijuana, finally returning to the United States in the early 1990s and dying in Southern California. Now, Pedro Gonzalez is a, to us, he's a hero of the American press. He used his radio show to expose conditions that other people did not want to expose. And for it, he was persecuted, he was jailed, he was deported. And yeah, he's virtually sort of unknown in the histories of American radio or in or of the press in America.
Yeah, and why is he unknown? Why wouldn't that story be? And I guess I wonder if there's a difference between those times and these times. Would that story be highlighted now, and why wasn't it then? It is a remarkable story.
There was a PBS documentary that was done on his life about 10, 15 years ago, but it played a few times and it's never replayed. But basically, in the journalism histories and in the studies of radio, he's rarely, if ever, mentioned. And that's part of what we've tried to do with this book, is resurrect these stories of people who sacrificed to speak truth to power, to raise inconvenient truths, to alert the general population about injustices that were occurring in communities of color. And it's important, not only, especially given the change in the, not only the overall population of the country, but especially in the youth population of the country. Our urban public schools are largely black and brown today, and the young people who are studying their the history of the United States and the history of journalism need to know about these heroes and heroines of journalism that have sort of been not expunged but marginalized or forgotten in the current histories.
Yeah. Kathy, it still kind of exists today. One of the things of our book is that people of color, particularly in the media, have always been treated like the other, right? Here we have during World War II, World War I, as I mentioned before, there was this, the black press was unbelievably influential. Hundreds of thousands of subscribers per week, right? They had huge circulations. But yet, there was very little knowledge that it even existed. And I think I think we still know too little about each other today. Who are influential people of color in the media, in non-traditional media? I mean, who is Kathy Hughes, and who is all these different people who have had a major impact on black and Latino life? Who is Marielena Salinas or Jorge Ramos, and who are massive stars in the Spanish language community, and have, you know, which Univision may be is the fifth largest network in the country, but no one knows who they are.
No, they don't.
In the larger society, and that still plays out to this day. And it's a theme that continues to this very day.
Yes, Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I enjoy seeing Juan on Democracy Now! Regularly. So I have two questions. One relates to the racial minority press usually is community-based that we talk about, but we also had national overtly political papers, the Young Lords paper that Juan, I think, used to edit. The Akwesane Notes was a Native American paper nationally distributed. We had the Black Panther Party paper, of course, even The Call and Muhammad Speaks. So I'm interested in the difference in terms of national impact, national coordination compared to community-based papers. That's one question. And the other, in Wisconsin, we had a strong tradition of non-English press, particularly German-American, which was often dominant. Frederick Douglass overly generously once referred to Germans of his time, German-Americans, as being an anti-racist force. And I was just reading Eric Foner's book on Lincoln and slavery, and he said that the book says that Lincoln helped fund a German-American paper in Illinois in response to the political forces he was otherwise aligned with, pushing restriction on voting rights for immigrants so that you couldn't vote for until you were a citizen for 2 years or 10 years or something like that, even though in some places like Wisconsin you didn't have to be a citizen at all to vote, which was, of course, Europeans predominantly. So those are my two questions.
Thank you. Thanks, Art.
Well, in terms of the, I'll tackle the second question first. It is true that in the 19th century, especially, the largest foreign language press was the German language press, and even larger than the Spanish language press, which was, I think, the second largest throughout the 19th century in the country. But the and that the German immigrant press was much more anti-racist and progressive than other foreign language presses of the time. We talk about, for instance, in San Antonio, where a considerable number of German immigrants settled in the 1850s. The first foreign language newspaper in San Antonio was not a Spanish language newspaper. It was a German language newspaper. And San Antonio was then, the local government had been had a know-nothing anti-immigrant majority in the city council, and the German immigrants and the original Mexican settlers of San Antonio banded together to try to oppose the white supremacist and anti-immigrant local government at the time, so that there was definitely a common cause in some areas between African Americans, the German press, and Mexicans in the conquered southwestern territories of the United States, in terms of the national press, there clearly was a national press that existed among people of color early on. I think Joe has mentioned the biggest example. Both the Chicago Defender and the Pittsburgh Courier were black weekly newspapers, but they circulated throughout the country because basically a lot of railroad workers would take the paper their papers on the railroads into the South, and it was the Defender, in fact, that really began pressing for blacks to leave the Jim Crow South and move north. At the turn of the 20th century, both the Defender and the Courier were basically smuggled into the South by black railway workers, and then began urging the African American population to come north, where, of course, they then became the main vehicles for acculturating the new migrants from the South into the cities of Chicago and Pittsburgh and New York and others. So there was a national press then, and that was there was a national press going back to the Garvey movement. The Garvey movement in the early 1900s had newspapers that really circulated internationally as well as in the United States. But then when a new left developed in the 60s and 70s, that same tradition of a national, much more political press was taken up by papers like the Black Panther newspaper and the Young Lords Palante newspaper and various other native papers. So there was this national press, but I think the real power of the press of people of color, like the power of the best of the mainstream press, has come from reporting on the local problems in a local community that the national press ignores. Because it's, you know, you can talk about what's going on in Washington, you can talk about what's going on with the in Congress, but who is going to report on what happens at your local school board, what happens with your local elections, what are the development projects in your neighborhood that could have an impact on the quality of life of your community? This has to be reported at the local level by a local newspaper or a local radio station that has the interests of that community at heart. And I think to that degree that there has been a rich minority press. It has been part of this effort in American journalism to, because this is a big country. It's a huge country. And no national press can cover what's going on in all of the various communities and states and towns. And you've got to have that local press doing that job.
And that local press, it seems to me, is doing a much better job than many local broadcast outlets, that the broadcast outlets used to have people who were actively reporting state government news and City Hall, and even the white newspapers used to do a much better job of that. You get that kind of news now from the minority press, at least in this community, I think. It's kind of interesting that they have taken up the charge to do something that you would think the local press would find it important to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, local broadcasters have, I mean, really, the numbers show it, have really abandoned reporting. So many of them, the amount of cuts to the local newsroom is just unbelievable over the past decade. Meanwhile, the companies are still very, very profitable, these local news outlets. And now with Citizens United, all the ad campaign, all ad money.
Oh, my gosh, companies, yes.
They're making a lot of money now off because of Citizens United, so it is a major problem, and again we just believe that one of the reasons is because these companies, the FCC is not enforcing the rules, and it's supposed to serve a public interest, right, in exchange for that license, and they're more and more just refusing to do that. Even though there's more news all around the clock, it's just, like you said, they're cutting all the different bureaus and all the different, investigative reporting is gone from local news altogether, just about.
We welcome more phone calls. Our guests are the authors of News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. Juan Gonzalez is the winner of the George Polk Award for Investigative Reporting, former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, co-host of the nationally syndicated TV and radio show Democracy Now!, and columnist for New York's Daily News. He has written several books. Joseph Torres is the senior advisor for government and external affairs for Free Press, the National Media Reform Organization. Before that job, he worked as deputy director at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and was a journalist for several years. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. Or you're always welcome to send an email if you would like to do that. That's talk at WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your calls, Patty in Fox Cities. Hi, Patty.
Hi. First of all, I want to say thank you for all the great work that you've done. And I just tuned into the program a while ago, so I don't know if you may have already touched on this. And it doesn't have so much to do with the race aspect of the program topic, but more with the media control. And I'm referring to a story that came across the wire this morning about the upcoming G8 and NATO summits that are going to be occurring in Chicago in May.
Mm-hmm.
And the talk about the pinching of the streaming of the videos because of all the protesting that they're expecting to take place when this occurs. And just kind of, there was also some stuff about a little bit of outline of, other instances where this has been done, not only internationally, but, in the States when there's been, some big protests. And, just the fact that somebody might actually have their finger and the ability to just kind of like decompress or control the stream of information bothers me. And I realize this doesn't have anything to do with the print media. It's all digital. But, I'm a little alarmed by that. So whatever comments you'd have on that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
It is a major issue right now. You've seen it with all the Occupy protests, the number of journalists that have been arrested, or just the way in which police, the law enforcement officials are trying to interfere with the people's ability to use their smartphone to record what's going on. Press freedoms have been under attack in the past few months, here, even though we talk about what's going on across the world with press freedoms that are going on, and it's it is a major issue, and we have to be vigilant about it, particularly with technology. We've seen it happen in San Francisco last year with the BART in Oakland with the there's going to be a protest using and the BART shut down their ability for people to use their Wi-Fi and to organize using their smartphones. So it's a major issue that we have to continue to watch.
We haven't, there's so much in the book that you can only get to so much in our conversation, but you talk about the role of the white press, and I think we should spend some time on this, in fomenting mob violence and massacres against non-white communities in one of the lurid scandals of American journalism. And you cite examples in the book, the anti-abolitionist riots of 1835, anti-Chinese pogroms in the western states, the Camp Grant massacre of Apaches in 1871. I mean, there are a whole list of these that I think people know virtually little to nothing about.
Yes, well, one of the we make the point that it wasn't just an issue of the mainstream or white press distorting the lives of people of color or propagating stereotypes, but in many instances, and we think we've done a really good job in actually telling the stories of many of these instances. We have dozens of examples in the book, not only of lynchings that were actually fomented by local newspapers or race riots fomented by radio stations, but we actually name who were the publishers and the station owners and how they functioned. And I think the biggest one that we found to be the most startling, because it represented a figure who became a major political figure in the country, was the Wilmington coup of 1898, when in November 1898, a band of 2,000 armed whites of North Carolina marched into the town of Wilmington, which had a majority black population and still had one of the few majority Reconstruction local governments. A majority of the city council was African American at the time. And they marched in. They burned down the local black newspaper, Alexander Manley's Wilmington Record. They rounded up all of the elected black officials of the town at gunpoint, ordered them out of town, installed a Confederate former Confederate colonel as the new mayor of Wilmington, and proceeded to shoot up the black community. Dozens of people were killed. Hundreds fled the city. This was the only successful armed coup, we think, in American history of a local government. No one was ever prosecuted or held responsible for the crimes and that were committed that day. But the amazing thing was that the entire thing was orchestrated and organized by the leading newspaper publisher of North Carolina, Josephus Daniels, publisher of the News and Observer, Josephus Daniels later became, because he was a populist, he was a confidant of Woodrow Wilson. When Wilson was elected president, he was named Secretary of the Navy by Woodrow Wilson. He served as our Secretary of the Navy during World War One, and he later became ambassador to Mexico, named by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had been one of his subordinates at the Navy, in the Navy Department. So here you had Josephus Daniels, a leading publisher, who became a major figure in American politics, and yet he organized the burning of a black newspaper, the killing of dozens of people, and openly admitted that he used his newspaper to basically prepare the ground for the coup by meeting at night with the leaders of the white supremacist movement and plotting what stories they would put in the paper to stir up the white community. It's an astonishing story that's virtually unknown.
It is an astonishing story.
In American journalism.
Yeah, well, there's a book in that, gentlemen.
So, you know, if I can add to that, I just opened up one of my books I have in my office here, a historic book about the history of the press, a very popular book. It says Josephus Daniels was the a champion of decency. Oh. A champion of decency. He established around the News and Observer, obtained control in 1995. He became one of the leading Southern newspapers. He was a great supporter of the Democratic Party, but he was, you know, he was a champion of decency. This is how history is recorded. Josephus Daniels in the American press has. He's seen as a great newspaper editor and a publisher, and few people know the other side of what he really is.
Mm. Well, you will leave us to think about that as we say goodbye to both of you. Thank you so much for writing the book and for being with us this hour. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, thank you, Heather.
Our thanks this hour of the program to the authors of News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race in the American Media. Juan Gonzalez and Joseph Torres are guests. The book has just been published, and it's huge project, 7 years in the making, because they go way back to the beginning of journalism, the colonial newspaper in this country. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. There will be great conversations ahead on the network, so please stay with us, and we'll be joining you again tomorrow from 9 to 11. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.